Welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the show that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about, you know what? You can just guess. Week on week, we're just going to ask you just to guess what we are talking about, what we are talking about this week. It's just me and Pat today. Milo is away on a bit of personal business. It'll be all three of the lads, the three guys, next week, and we are about to embark on discussing another series. You asked, we heard, we have answered your call, and we are going to be doing 2010's Spartacus Blood and Sand. How are you doing, Pat?
I had forgotten how much I enjoyed this show. And I feel like I appreciate it so much more now than I did when I first watched it. I first watched this, I was in graduate school, I was doing my PhD. I was doing a lot of Roman history. I was super excited about it. I was also still very much a younger bro at the time, which meant that the more, shall we say, titillating aspects of this this production had held some appeal. Still do, not gonna lie. But it was a very different experience watching it to talk about for this than it was back then. I appreciate the difference in my perspective on it. And I think I really appreciate it more. Like there's so much that I like about it. There are things that I don't, but there's a lot that I like about it. And I'm very, very excited to discuss it. I think it's probably one of my favorite full series of all time.
Wow.
So I'm pretty stoked. I'm pretty excited.
That's big talk.
Yeah, I don't say that lightly.
Big talk from the boy one. You didn't even have to. You didn't even have to smoke weed in order to watch it.
No. Does it add to the experience? Of course, 100%. But is it necessary? No, not strictly. You can watch this one. Not even California sober. Like sober, and you're good to go.
Watch it. You can watch it sober.
That's hard for me to have higher praise than that.
Oh, that's real. That's real New Yorker style critical engagement. Like, I don't even have to smoke to watch this.
Yeah. Like, it's not have to. It's what is it necessary to bring it up to a basic level of enjoyment? And with this
basic
series,
level of watchability.
Yeah, this series, I would say no. Those About to Die, very, very much a necessity.
Those About to Die is obviously like our, you know, our kind of benchmark for on what should be bad Roman history series. This one, little Spartacus Blood and Sand. It's also something that I watched when it was out. I enjoyed it very much. Me and some friends used to watch it every Monday night. We would get together and we would get in a few beers and we would watch it sounds unhinged when you put it like this, but we would watch a triple bill. We would start with America's Next Top Model, then we would watch Glee, then we would watch Spartacus Blood and Sand.
Can you walk me through the progression of what one of those evenings looked like?
Every single possible constellation of genders is represented in these three TV shows. I'm just saying that was inclusion. What we used to do on a Monday.
Absolutely.
Night.
Look at you. Look at how far ahead of your time you guys were.
Yeah.
That's, exactly. I mean, just the most progressive.
Like, I wish I could tell you how we had arrived at this particular combination of TV shows, but unfortunately, I don't have the answer for you. We were watching Spartacus Blood and Sand because it was out and we were all studying. So it like seemed like a kind of fun thing, sort of like a fun thing to kind of do as a sort of like, As like a kind of follow along. It felt like a kind of enrichment process. It's like we're in the library like all day.
Like you're gonna like, get extra credit in a degree program for
exactly,
watching Spartacus.
Like, we're all working on our dissertations, and it's like, you know what? Like this is like the grad school equivalent of the primary school teacher wheeling out the TV on the last day of term, being like, ooh, and now we get to watch this. And also, like, everyone who hung out on Monday nights, we were all ancient historians and classicists. So we didn't even have anyone to, like, be annoying to about it. We were just like annoying to each other. So like if someone spotted something that like that's like not right, we're like, you know, there's not really significant evidence for there being a particular contemporary interest in Spartacus and the slave rebellion. You know, that's it's a later interpolation, and everyone else being like, yeah, I did know that. How's about that rendition of Me Against the Music that we just saw on Glee?
I mean, first of all, I just have to say, you're describing a perfectly kind of 2010 experience. This is very 2010 coded in the best way. Like those things, America's the specific combination of America's Next Top Model, Glee, and Spartacus speaks so directly to the world of the Great Recession and which now feels like a historical period to me. Like it feels like we have enough distance from it that it is clearly different things were happening than are happening now. Like leaving aside, current discussion of how we live in an endless present, that really does feel like a distinct historical era. And this show is very much a product of a distinct historical era, I would say.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And I will tell you this for nothing. Having not that long ago, for different reasons, watched both for the first time in 15 years, watched both an episode of Glee and you don't need to know why, it's not important why, and also watched an episode of America's Next Top Model for reasons.
I don't need to know. You keep that to yourself.
Which don't have to be obscure to you, Pat, but they do have to be obscure to the noble listener, because it's none of your business while I was watching America's Next Top Model. Mind your beeswax. It feels more historically alien to me to watch an episode of America's Next Top Model than it does to watch an episode of Spartacus, Blood and Sand.
Yeah, I buy that.
Like that, it feels more kicked out of time and place. The past is a truly dangerous, villainous, unnavigable country to watch an episode of Glee than it does to watch an episode of Spartacus, Blood and Sand.
So that actually, that's a really interesting point, because one of the things that occurred to me in watching this show back is that you could put it on TV today and it would fit just fine.
Yeah.
I think that's a testament. There's kind of an underlying quality here. Like not everything in this show works. Not everything in it is perfect or necessarily even good. There are things that you can look at and be like, that's kind of cringy, or this was not well done, or this part was not well written or well acted. Those things are present in this show. But I think there's a basic sophistication to the way that it understands itself and the Roman world. There's a kind of a fundamental radicalism to the perspective that it takes. Mm-hmm. That I think is really, really, really interesting, that almost fits better with a kind of a post-2020 world than it does the time when it came out. Because what's so interesting about this show and why it's worth watching at a basic level, I think it's important to get this out of the way at the very start as we're getting into it. It takes extraordinarily seriously the idea of oppression and the view from the bottom. It is committed to that perspective on power, relationships, violence, sex. So as lurid at a basic level as a lot of this show looks, right? Like it very much, it's very easy to kind of lump it in with 300 aesthetically when the first time you glance at it. But it's a prime example of why it's not just the visual that matters, it's the reason for it. And the reason they do it this way in this show is to highlight those disparities and to highlight who's looking down and who's looking up, to highlight the difference between the ground and the sky, the surrealism of what's happening for the people who are involved. Like you think about the basic frame of reference for this show is a guy who's beaten up, dragged away from his village and tossed into an arena And think about how disorienting that would be and how foreign it would be, an alien. And you're looking at the world and you're like, what the fuck is happening? And so when Spartacus, the guy that we know is going to be Spartacus, is on the sands of the arena and looking up and you see how disoriented he is, the kind of slow motion sprays of blood, the like freeze frame shots of like a woman's bosom and uncovered bosom in the crowd, which at first glance you could look at and be like, that's kind of gauche, that's kind of classless, like what are they doing, why is this here? It actually makes sense from the perspective of this guy is looking at these things and just catching scattered images, and you're not experiencing things as kind of a straightforward narrative, like a stream of things coming at you. You see this and your eyes catch on it, you see that and your eyes catch on it. And it's so different than 300, where it's blood for the sake of blood. It's sex for the sake of sex. It's like, it's incredibly, it's gutter. Like 300 is gutter. And even though this has the aesthetic hallmarks of that kind of gutter register, it's not doing that. It's doing something very different with those same kind of basic tools.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that vein, if we apply Dr. Wyman's rubric for shows about the ancient world, is this a costume drama or is this a historical drama?
It's a historical drama. Mm-hmm. And because its basic way of understanding the ancient world is consonant with the actual views, perspectives, and actions of people in the ancient world. They may be heightened, they may be taken up a notch for dramatic effect or for kind of shock value, but the basic values, the power relationships that define the world, the all of that stuff is spot on. The kind of petty ambition that's driving all of the Roman characters that we see in this, right? This desire to one-up someone else, to be the most important guy, to have the crowd look at you and cheer, to seek out the next command. All of that is so deeply fucking Roman. It's perfect that they've nailed exactly the right tone for a kind of a whiny legate who wants his chance at glory, has been given his chance at glory by a good marriage, and goes out and ruins a bunch of people's lives. That is incredibly late Roman Republic. That is the perfect vibe to catch.
It absolutely is. Okay, so let's do a quick overview of what happens in this episode. It's like it's setting everything up. Mm-hmm. This is the intro episode. This is the prologue. It takes place in 73 BC, and I cannot remember exactly who is in charge of everything in 73 BC. Once upon a time, I was able to like just like reel it off. I could have told you who the consuls, who the consuls and probably who the praetors were and the tribunes on that year. I can't do that anymore because I'm 100 years old.
But it's insane that you ever had that, because I never did. Like, that's fucking wild. You know that, right? Like, that's insane that you could at some point do that.
I could do it. I had the entire Julio-Claudian family tree in my head, like at any one time. It was like my party trick. And that was particularly fun because I was able to tell you the full names of a bunch of guys who had functionally the same name, but just like in a different order.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I could do that. That was my party trick.
I don't think calling it a party trick is selling it way short. That's fucking insane that you could do that.
Yeah, but yeah, no, I can't do it now. It wasn't a year of any of the big hitters. I feel like it might have been like one of the Longinus guys that were like knocking around.
But
that might have been the year after.
This is in broad strokes, this is the period after Sulla's restoration of the Republic, right? So you have, there's decades of civil war in the early first century BC, most focused at first around Marius and Sulla. Sulla eventually emerges victorious from this kind of this round of civil wars. Sulla, quote unquote, restores the Republic. He basically introduces a whole new political system where the kind of ladder of offices is set in stone. There are certain privileges given to certain groups of society that had been traditional before, but now, again, they're explicitly laid out. It's more or less an attempt to codify constitutionally a specific version of Republican government. Mm. And when Sulla does this, then he leaves. He goes to an island, or does he go? He goes to a villa somewhere, and then
he goes to a villa and then just chills out.
Yeah, there's a lot of sex with people who with kind of exotic sexual preferences is how Sulla's retirement went.
So far as we know.
So that this is what people said. Sulla retires after a reign of terror. It completely remakes Roman political society. Hundreds of people are killed, like powerful people, like people who matter, die. Tens of thousands of average everyday folk die. Sulla does this, and then he just goes to a villa to fuck until the end of his life. Like that's it. I mean, credit for knowing when it's time to step away. Credit for knowing what you want, I suppose.
History's biggest hear me out is Sulla, if you ask me. Another big important thing that Sulla did. It got taken back, but it did happen. Which was just a really brief note about the constitutional and political arrangements of the Roman Republic. If you were a very, very ordinary person, in terms of representation, you're not doing so hot. These are well-off people rearranging the furniture. Certainly by the end of the first century BC. They're not just like rearranging the furniture. They're like smashing the furniture up. They're like trying to stab each other with the shards of the furniture. That's what's going on. Everyone's like very, very kind of caught up. Whether or not your family like stretches back to the ab urbe conditor, or whether you're a new man, and it's all just rich guys.
Yes,
rich guys, and a lot of fail sons, a lot of people who are only people that we have heard of because their dad was rich, his dad was rich. They are like, even though we don't call it the Roman Empire, they are rich people at functionally an imperial court enjoying the spoils of extraction.
Yes, that is such a great way to put it. And I think to put this in kind of global context, when we're talking about other extraordinarily privileged elite groups, the Roman elite is a pretty small group of people. It's a few hundred families with a few thousand members, and the spoils of two centuries of essentially continuous conquest have flowed into this group of people. Yep. The lion's share of the plunder that they've managed to extract from the entire Mediterranean and beyond has flowed to this small group of people. So in global context, when we're talking about very long periods of history and different elite groups in different times and places, this is one of the richest, most powerful, most influential, frankly spoiled groups of people that has ever existed in human history. I can't put it more strongly than that. I mean, the comparison for it is like billionaires living in the 21st century. That's how wealthy, powerful, influential, removed from the concerns of the vast majority of people who are alive. That's how privileged they were.
Yeah, exactly. And that's important. That's important to keep in your head. And so if you're an ordinary person, you are like you're functional an irrelevance.
Yes.
To the people who are in charge of you. But every so often, they throw up a kind of a sop to the idea that there is some kind of representation for ordinary people within this structure. And because they're Romans, they like to come up with some mad story, which is the kind of mytho-historical reasoning behind it. And for the Romans of the late Republic, this mad reasoning was this almost certainly fictional, don't come at me, almost certainly fictional event called the Secession of the Plebs, when the ordinary people of Rome said, right, fuck this. Absolutely fuck this. We're going to go stand on that hill. And we're not coming down. See how you cope with running the city without us. We're going to be up there, going to be up that hill. And refused to come down until several things were put in place. Among them was the codification of the law, code of the 12 tables, which was meant to at least in part be aimed at preventing aristocratic abuses of ordinary people, or certainly unconstitutional aristocratic abuses of ordinary people. So there was a thing that was written down saying they can do this, but they can't do this. There's like this whole kind of section about like exactly how many pounds of chain you're allowed to put your debtors in. It's like stuff like that. It got turned into this kind of cultural memory object of being like the kind of the central storage house of like all that made Rome and Romans and Rome's law great, and the center of the world, and these amazing constitutional arrangements. And in fact, later law codes said that this law code was their inspiration. I think there's even a bit in Justinian's law code saying this is the new 12 tables. But it's so like specific, it's so specific, and it's so agrarian. But another thing that was meant to have come out of the Secession of the Plebs was the introduction of an office called the Tribune of the Plebs. And this was a guy who was supposed to be able to represent ordinary people, the interests of ordinary people in the passing of bills, laws, and so on and so forth. And they had something called a tribunician veto. So if a senator proposes something, technically the tribune of the plebs can say, absolutely not, you're not doing that. This is that's a big deal. It's their one big power. And there was a tribune who attracted the ire of Sulla by vetoing a bunch of his stuff. And so when Sulla started to introduce reforms, he came up with this. It's quite a good idea, really. If you really, really want to fuck with someone who annoyed you, he altered the trajectory and turned the tribune into the highest possible office of this one particular kind of route. So if you had held the plebeian tribunate, you could not do anything else. You couldn't rise, you couldn't be a quaestor, you couldn't be a praetor, you definitely couldn't be a consul. And once upon a time, you could technically use this post as your stepping stone in the kind of the first stage of a very standard Roman political career. And Sulla was like, no, this is a dead end now to be. So it basically stopped people from wanting to be the tribune. Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of the backdrop that we're dealing with in this show. And just very, very briefly, like I said, it is the setup. The guy in it, the legate, is the real commander. Yes. In the servile and the servile wars. But this is why it's widely thought that it is much later that the rebellion of Spartacus, the slave rebellion of Spartacus, was deemed to be this really important cultural event, and it was invested with all of this meaning much later rather than at the time, is because we only have like one mention of this legate. He's literally a nobody. So like in terms of like contemporary sources, and in fact, I think that we don't have anything that like even that attests him until Plutarch and Appian, who are a lot later. So that they would have used contemporary sources, but no one gave a shit about this guy, which suggests that no one really gave a shit about the rebellion.
Yeah, it becomes a big deal later on. This is actually the third servile war. So this is the third of a series of large scale slave insurrections that happen after about the middle of the second century BC. in specific areas of Italy, not everywhere in Roman Italy, and it is becoming Roman Italy at this point, rather than the Italian peninsula with Rome and a bunch of other Italic peoples. There's a kind of a broad convergence of political rights, ways of doing things, political institutional arrangements. Basically, Italy is becoming Roman, whatever that means. There's a lot of different things that it could mean. Not all parts of this, of Italy, would have had huge numbers of slaves. That's not a universal aspect of the Roman economy at this point in time. But I want to talk a little bit about kind of the economic and social arrangements that lead us to a point where you can have a large scale slave rebellion. Mm-hmm. So there had been slavery in Rome in some form from the very beginning. We know this because it's in the 12 tables. There are references to what are obviously chattel slaves in the 12 tables. But slavery only really takes off in Rome after around 300 BC, give or take a decade or two. And the overwhelming source of enslaved people is war. There in the ancient world, this is true of all ancient societies from the Mediterranean. The victor in war has the absolute right to dispose of the conquered in any way they see fit. They can kill them. They can set them free. They can enslave them. They can set them to work. Whatever you want to do with people who have been defeated in war, you are allowed to do. That is as a fundamental fact, that is just a true thing in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. So as Rome, over the course of the late 4th, 3rd century into the 2nd century, embarks on these increasingly large-scale and successful military campaigns all over the Mediterranean, they take enormous numbers of captives. So there is a slave trade, which is smaller scale, that's moving individuals, groups, you know, from mostly from the frontiers inward. There's a domestic supply of slaves, enslaved people who have children and their children are slaves. Abandoned children are often raised as slaves in a household. But the overwhelming source of enslaved people is large-scale military conflict. And so what you end up with in certain, and when these slaves are brought from the periphery to the core, they're overwhelmingly brought to Italy, they're concentrated in particular areas and particular occupations. So mines, quarries, the most brutal, backbreaking work that you really can't get anyone else to do, that overwhelmingly depends on a continuous supply of lots of slaves. There are also big agricultural, like kind of plantations, we would think of them, called latifundia, overwhelmingly owned by this extraordinarily rich senatorial aristocracy. You lease out a bunch of ager publicus, it's publicly owned land. You build some facilities on it, and then you just buy 500 slaves and you set them to work. And all of a sudden, you've got a thriving agricultural enterprise. And when we're talking about how the late Roman aristocracy becomes, or the late Republican aristocracy becomes so wealthy, it's that they take the profits of these wars, which overwhelmingly accrue to them. It's not that other people don't benefit from Roman imperialism, they do, but overwhelmingly the benefits accrue to this group. They take the money that they get and they invest it, essentially, in land, villas, and in human labor. So there's this easy cycle that you can see happening basically from 300 BC onward, where the Roman aristocracy gets richer and richer and richer and more and more and more powerful. And the way that expresses itself in kind of the social and economic landscape is these increasingly large-scale slave-operated enterprises. And so if you're wondering why there are enough enslaved people with enough of a lack of supervision that they can organize large scale rebellions, these are the dynamics that lead us to this point. Mm-hmm. So Spartacus's rebellion is actually the third of these. There's a couple of them in Sicily in the preceding few decades. They're a big deal. They really freak out the Romans. And interestingly, after this one, Roman slavery seems to soften a fair bit. After the Spartacus rebellion, the Roman slavery really seems to become a kind of a softer, gentler form. It's still bad, but it is not as bad. So the point where this show is set marks the absolute high point of the Roman economic slavery machine, the war and slavery machine that powers Rome. This conflict happens right at the very peak of that, and at the point where enslaved people are treated the absolute worst of any point in Roman history. That's the essential context for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is that's really important, and that's a really, really helpful summary. So Spartacus himself, the man who becomes Spartacus, he is nameless. He is a nameless Thracian who gets recruited by this Roman legate in a planned military expedition against a people called the Getae, and they persuade the Thracians that they are they're at great risk from this barbarian people, and they will they promise you kind of the protection of Rome if you kind of get involved. The nameless Thracian decides that, well, no, I'm not doing that. That sounds rubbish. I'm not doing that at all. And so deserts. This does not go down terribly well. And both he and his this is the potted version. Both he and his wife end up being clapped in irons and forced into slavery. He shows up at some kind of local gladiatorial games, which feels almost like a sort of trope at this point. Like they start out in like kind of small towns. They start out on the circuit. They start out, they're doing the open mics, they're kind of earning their stripes, like working on their tight five. And then they get spotted in this case, by John Hanna, who has a gladiatorial school in Rome, and is all like, huh, I'm gonna bring this guy and show him in this in my games. He's gonna be the greatest gladiator I've ever trained, because for these local amateur games, town and county level CrossFit games that they've got going on.
I think that's
the analogy, I think.
Yeah, what's the third or fourth tier soccer team in Cambridge? Like Cambridge FC, Cambridge United?
Yeah.
This is the Cambridge United of gladiatorial games.
Yep. Okay. Fine. Yeah.
It's a lower tier operation. It is connected to the higher tier. Right. Like there are institutional and organizational connections to higher tiers of this. But Capua is an important city. It's a pretty rich city. Campania is a very wealthy region of Roman Italy. It's pretty tightly connected to Rome. The first big road that the Romans ever build in 312 BC is the Appian Way. And where does that go? It goes to Capua. So Capua is very tightly integrated with Rome itself and with kind of the core region there. It's very wealthy, but it is still, it's not Rome. And by this point, we have to understand Rome is already an imperial city. It already has hundreds of thousands of inhabitants. There are sophisticated institutional structures that make it possible for you to have that, namely the grain dole. Rome is already at a different level. Capua really is a backwater in comparison. Mm.
And that's why John Hanna's there.
I love him so much.
Yeah, so do I.
We've discussed the mummy on this show before, right?
We have, and we have not done the mummy, but I feel like...
God damn, we need to.
I feel like we should.
We're putting that on the list, but I love the mummy and I love John Hanna in it. He's so good in that. He's so good in this. He's a good character in this episode. He becomes a truly great character of the Golden Age of TV, I think.
Wow. You're really going for it.
I was pondering this as I was watching this, like, where does this rank in my kind of pantheon of shows from this period of time? I don't think it's the best one. It is one of my favorites in the sense that I enjoyed it a very great deal. And I think it has not everyone, not every performance, not every actor, not every role, the way it's written is great, but it does have some great ones. And I think that the character of Badiatis in this so perfectly captures something about this upwardly grasping, this really core aspect of what made the Romans Romans, I think he so perfectly nails it. I think the way that John Hannah plays him is perfect too.
Yeah.
So not everyone, not the whole show, not every character. I don't actually think Spartacus, the character of Spartacus, is perfect in either this season or the seasons that follow. He's there as a reflection of these other characters. It's not Spartacus himself. And this is one of the kind of the tricky things about this show, is that it is backdooring a show about power relations, slavery, and the nature of imperial oppression into a sword and sandals epic about Spartacus.
Yeah, I think, yeah, no, that I think that's right. I mean, I think it's like one of those things which functions as one of those stories where the main character is very deliberately a kind of a flat.
Mm-hmm. He's like Paddington. Spartacus is Paddington, uh-huh. Where everything else, because
you also said that Jack Sparrow is Paddington.
He is, because that's not because
you can't
I'm upset.
Say everyone's Paddington.
It's structurally they are, and I'll tell you why. Okay. I will tell you why. That is a distinct form of structuring a narrative, because the whether the main character changes or not, and how the main character changes, is the driving point of every story, right? Is it fall? Is it rise? Is it rise and then fall? What is their arc? And that is basically the arc that gives its shape to the story as a whole. Mm-hmm. In Paddington, the main character does not change. The main character remains who they are the whole time. It's their presence in that world that changes everyone else around them. And that's what gives that story its shape. That's what Jack Sparrow does in Pirates of the Caribbean. And it's what Spartacus does here, where the titular main character is not the one who undergoes this profound dramatic transformation. The values that we see in Spartacus in the very first episode of this show are the same values that drive Spartacus all the way up to the very end. It three seasons hence, that character does not change. Things about him change. His views on certain things change. The way he interacts with people change. He comes into himself as a leader. But those aspects of his character are present at the beginning and they're present at the end. It's the effect of that character on everyone around him that drives the story of the show. That's the distinction I would draw.
Okay.
That's why he's Paddington.
Okay. Now I accept the characterization. Do you think that maybe, I don't know, like Aeneas is a better comparant than Paddington?
I mean, perhaps, but you know what? I'm going to stick with Paddington.
You're going to stick with Paddington?
I'm going to stick with Paddington because I think the Paddington movies, God bless them. I have watched them with my children. They're extraordinarily good. And they really nail this particular story structure, which is hard to pull off. It's not easy to do, to have a main character who doesn't really change, even as their circumstances do and everything around them changes. Like, that's a difficult story structure to work with. You've got a lot of threads you've got to balance. You've got to think very hard about how people interact with each other and what matters to them. And how people can change each other. That's big stuff. And so when I say Paddington, you have to understand, I don't mean that as some sort of like diminutive or like infantilizing way of understanding a story. It's that I think they did that so fucking well that it's the gold standard for how you tell a story where the main character doesn't change. That's my Paddington point.
Is the Paddington point. The line is Paddington. We are not departing.
The line is Paddington. Paddington. Yeah.
The line is Paddington.
Jack Sparrow is probably a second. I think the way they do Jack Sparrow in the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie is also a pretty perfect exploration of it.
But is also a Paddington.
He's not bad. He's not good enough. He's not good enough to be Paddington.
He's not good enough to be Paddington.
Johnny Depp is no Paddington. I think we all know that.
I think if I saw Depp in a duffel coat and a sou'west, I don't think I'd be very happy.
No, it wouldn't be the weirdest thing you've seen him wearing, though.
No, that's true. Why does Paddington wear a duffel coat? I wouldn't imagine there's much use for a duffel coat in Peru.
You know, I don't know. We could ask him.
What's up with the marmalade? What's he up to?
A lot of questions.
Why does he need so much zest?
Yeah.
Why is he such a zesty little bear?
Look, because he is.
What's
and
he got
his
on his
zest inspires all of those around him.
Mm. So the problem is for me is that Paddington is also a god of death. And that's something which I find difficult to square with his duffel coat and his hat.
I can see that. Yeah. Yeah.
Has he got anything on under the duffel coat?
No, he doesn't need
I've never seen Paddington.
No, bear the
one or two or three.
No, bears are not required. You're like that's totally fine.
So why is he wearing a coat? He's got a coat. He's a bear.
What if he gets cold? There are high mountains in Peru, Phoebe. Very high mountains.
All right. So what you're telling me is if I went to Peru and asked to see the bears, they would all be wearing coats.
Well, the speaking ones, I would assume.
Would they be nude like bears?
It's a good question. I don't have an answer for you. I'm going to assume the talking ones would wear a coat.
I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
If you see a bear and it's not wearing a coat, is that bear nude? Or is that bear just being a bear?
Bear is just being a bear, but a bear that can speak is aware that it is nude, would be my basic.
Okay. So we're biblical now. We're being biblical.
Yes.
So the bear who can speak has knowledge and is therefore aware of its nudity and ashamed of it and seeks to cover it up with the duffel coat.
Not ashamed of it, but aware of the social convention.
Aware of the social convention.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because there's not a lot of space in human society for naked people.
Correct. Yeah. That would be my basic take. I think
why is he wearing a hat? What's the hat about?
Well, it's a nice hat.
It is a nice hat.
You can just wear a nice hat.
It is a nice hat. Do you have any update on the marmalade situation?
I don't know. That one. We all must have a little mystery in our lives.
You
don't look convinced here.
I'm not totally convinced.
You're a Paddington skeptic, and that's okay.
I'm a Paddington skeptic. I mean, the thing is, like, I like marmalade. I think marmalade is a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I like that it's got the bits of zest in it. It's a lot of fun. It's like you're eating it. And you're like, oh, it's orange jam. Like, oh, now there's a bit of peel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That feels like we've got a little bit of a party going on. Certainly, like more of a party than your other standard set gelatin spreads. It's not gelatin, is it? It's pectin.
I have nothing to add to the gelatin pectin discussion.
To the gelatin pectin debate. You know what? The gelatin pectin discussion, that's going to get heated. So I think we should probably move on from it because like, it's just one of those things where like, it's such a site of polarization.
It is.
Pectin, gelatin.
You know what's not a site of polarization?
What?
Dildo helmet.
Dildo helmet. That's true. Can we talk a bit about it?
I would love to talk about the dildo helmet. Yeah. Okay. So again, when at first glance you watch this show and like this is what effectively amounts to a degenerate orgy scene, right? Mm-hmm. Where this is designed to show us just how fucking gross these people are.
Yeah.
And that's why it works, is because we're not supposed to be titillated by it. Really. We're supposed to take a step back and think, it's so fucked up that these people can do this, can make these people do this stuff for their entertainment and pleasure.
Yeah.
And the dildo helmet, which we see multiple shots of, they really get a lot of mileage out of the dildo helmet.
Well, it's probably expensive. They're probably like, you know what? Yeah. You know what? Like they have like the kind of, they have the, like the producer being like, you spent how much on a dildo helmet? I better see that thing in every single scene. You spent 3/4 of the budget on this thing.
Yeah.
I don't care how extraneous it is to the scene. I want to see that dildo helmet. I want to see cost per use.
You wanted the dildo helmet? Use the goddamn dildo helmet. That's I think that's absolutely a discussion that was had while the show was being made. And so again, this is the kind of thing you look at it and you're like, well, that's a fucking weird detail. The Romans loved disembodied cocks. They loved a disembodied phallus. So even if the dildo helmet per se is not historically accurate. I can't speak to that. I don't know the archaeological evidence of dildo helmets well enough to be able to say.
And you can't Google it. You'll get put on a register.
Yeah, that's leading nowhere good, especially in the United States in 2025. I can't risk,
Googling
dildo helmet.
Even just for the public embarrassment.
No, it lines. But leaving that specific aspect aside, the Romans, there were disembodied dicks everywhere in the Roman world. Everywhere.
Yeah.
Roman boys wore a phallus necklace. It's called they literally did wear this thing. I was in one of my first Roman history courses. The professor passed one around the audience, and an evangelical Christian student got up and left and dropped the class because she was so offended by the idea of us handling a Roman phallus. Yeah, that's oof. Yeah, early 2000s United States, man.
I'm quite interested in how you approach the study of Roman history if you're an evangelical Christian.
I don't know. It was a general education class. It was the very first one I took, and I knew I wanted to do more advanced stuff, but it fulfilled a requirement, like one of our general education requirements. So I ended up taking the class. I went on a date with my TA in that class. She was great. She was really cool. Oh.
I remember years ago, I met this guy who was a Near Eastern specialist and taught Near Eastern studies. But he taught Near Eastern studies at one of those weird private evangelical,
yes,
like kind of Bible, sort of kind of Bible based colleges. And I said to him, "So how are you teaching Near Eastern studies to kids who are at an evangelical Bible college? How's that working out for you? How do you do it?" And he had a little think and just said, "With difficulty."
That sounds right. Yeah. So I've met a lot of these people, and a lot of them are very into ancient history, surprisingly into ancient history, but they're very into their specific idea of what ancient history was. And So
if you try and do prehistory with them, and they're just like, no.
No, not so much that, because that they won't engage with at all. They'll look at it and they'll just be like, nope, not real, not messing with it, not interested in it. But they will seek out things that they think are relevant to their interests. So the episodes that I did on the early history of Israel and the Israelites, mm-hmm, for Tides of History, which I focused a great deal on, the archaeological evidence, the contemporary textual evidence, i.e. not the stuff that comes out of what eventually becomes the Jewish tradition, but, mm-hmm, but really like what people who are around at the time had to say about these people, Assyrians, Babylonians, and the evidence coming out of the ground, the archaeology. And I got a lot of responses that were like, well, but the Bible says this. And there's this one guy who's actually kind of a famous demographer. I would say he's one of these people who's very big into fertility, right? Like fertility, and people need to have more babies. He's one of these dudes.
Oh, like a pronatalist.
Yeah, he's one of them.
Oh,
but
cool.
a smart guy, like a pretty sophisticated thinker. But he launched a 47 tweet thread after I put this episode out, because I don't there is no archaeological evidence, period, whatsoever for the migration from Egypt to the Levant. Doesn't exist. Huh. They've looked really fucking hard. There is no indisputable evidence for this. I think the numbers of people involved are kind of implausible for a population movement at that time, et cetera, et cetera. And I said as much in the show. And this guy launches a 47 tweet thread about how, using advanced demographic methods, it's actually entirely plausible that the exile from Egypt went exactly as it is described in the book in Exodus, and that could in fact produce X number of people at this point in time who become Jews. Like that's, mm-hmm, that's the idea. And 47 tweets. And so, yes, they take this stuff very seriously. A lot of them are very interested in it, but you can't get them to focus on the weird shit or the stuff that isn't consonant with their worldview. is very difficult to break through that kind of conditioning. At least that's been my experience. Good for you guys. Get out there, learn about this stuff. I just always have a problem with people whose fundamental frameworks for understanding the world are so inflexible. That when they get new information, it doesn't alter that framework. They just kind of slot it into what they think they already know.
Yeah.
That I don't have much patience for. I think whether you want to call them priors or frameworks or kind of foundational ideas, those need to be flexible too, as new information comes in. And it drives me fucking crazy about these people that those are so set in stone. My son asked me last night what I believe if I don't believe in God, which was a fucking intense question to ask while he was messing around with some Legos. And I was like, first of all, I'm not sure I don't believe in God.
Children are deep, man.
I know. It's going to get crazy. It's going to get crazy out there. And I'm like, I don't know what I don't exactly know what I believe. I can tell you what these traditions say. I can tell you how I feel about some of these questions. I'm not sure that equates to what I would call belief. And so it's a very foreign experience for me to have that kind of unshakable sense that this is just indisputably true. It fucks with me. Really messes with me. I'm not comfortable with that kind of certainty.
Yeah. I feel like this is a very profound place that we've gone from just after me asking what Paddington's problem is with all the marmalade.
Record the episodes, Phoebe. Don't know where we're gonna go.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I've done some profound meditations on the nature of knowledge and belief, and also some profound meditations on dildo helmets.
The dildo helmet, it's perfect example of a thing that in the context of the show, if you just flipped it on, you'd look at it and you'd be like, what the fuck are they doing? Why do they think that's necessary? When you look at the whole thing and you look at the scenes as a coherent whole and the perspective that they're going with as a coherent whole, it actually works great. It is a consistent vision of what this world looks like and what its pathologies are and what's wrong with it. When Spartacus and the other Thracians, or the guy that is going to become Spartacus, our nameless Thracian, when they go into this party and they're looking at each other like, what is happening here? That's the reaction that you should have. Right? Like that, in some very deep way, you should look at this and be like, this is fucked up.
And of course, that's the value of centering the narrative around this nameless Thracian, because it invites you to, in a show about Roman history, it invites you to still take a kind of outsider's view. It's honestly quite a smart thing to do, because inevitably, if you're watching it now, of course you're going to take an outsider view. But if you are simultaneously kind of ushered in to the context and the world of the show, but also there is also an outsider who is there being like, what the fuck, man?
It's really deftly done.
Yeah, I agree.
In every way. And the way that it's edited and shot reinforces it, because they don't just skip over these things. They'll let us focus on a particularly discordant or strange or unexpected image. It'll kind of linger there for a minute. The camera will. And so it gives us as the viewers a little bit of time to process it and think through it and to have that reaction. And so I don't think I really appreciated the craft of this when the first time I watched it. And again, there are going to be things in the first, especially in the first few episodes, where you're like, what is happening here?
What is going on?
Yeah, there's going to be some of that. And again, characters that aren't well done, performances that are pretty subpar. But its overall frame is pretty fucking clever. I like it a lot. I like it even more than I did the first time. So
I remember it as being an excessively dumb sort of ultra sex and violence telling. And I actually don't remember it having kind of this level of deafness. To that end, I'd already, before I started watching it, written a short bit with our old friend Carol from HR.
What does Carol from HR have to say?
Carol from HR, who just needs to get the final numbers of everyone who is saying I am Spartacus, because lots of people have signed up, but not everybody has paid their money. There will be a collection going around at the end of the day. Simon's working from home. He's asked if he could dial in. So I did kind of scribble that down in my notes before I started watching it. And then I was like, actually, you know what? This isn't bad. So I feel like we've sort of gone in like quite a kind of different direction, but I do have some notes before we close out.
I'm sorry, I've talked so much here. Please. Please tell me more.
It's genuinely, it's been like a genuine, like genuinely fascinating exploration. Like when it was like suggested that we look at Spartacus Bonzan, I was like, oh, I remember. Like there's a bit in it. There's a bit where there's like this horrible big gross guy who wears like a mask made of other people's faces. And then when he kills someone, he cuts their face off and adds it to the mask. And so it's like a really like kind of disgusting kind of milfoil that he's got kind of like on his face. And that's sort of what I remembered about it. But yeah, so I've got a thing here saying, oh, we have Cockneys. Do you think that Glaber is frightened of the Cockneys because they remind him of the orcs that killed him when he was an elf? I was watching it quite late at night. I think I was just sort of... I've got a little quote here. The northern border of the land of piss and shit. I think that's a great way of describing basically anything. Glaber's missus is very head girl at Cheltenham, but I am delighted to say that we've got three female characters, and one of them is the Thracian's wife, who is standard, insipid, limp, sort of.
Yeah, pretty uncompelling character.
Both her and the Thracian are foils. They're kind of flat screens on which to project anything that you might wish to project on. But yeah, that it's a little bit unnecessary that when she gets taken away and forced into slavery, that she's like removed from her tent with her tits out. I think that's a little bit unnecessary, but you know, there we go. So she's very head girl at Cheltenham, but we have our first conniving Roman slag, which is very exciting. They do some shagging, which either is on a map or there's some unfortunate graphic design work, but I think they're shagging on a map.
They are. Yeah. But again, a great image. Like this is the Roman aristocracy, just fucking on a map and knocking all the pieces everywhere. A great metaphor for Rome at this period of time.
It really, really is. Then I've just got here. Yeah, right. I need the final numbers of everyone who's saying they're Spartacus tomorrow. Then I've got another bit about, oh, should we all pretend we're going to say it and then don't say it?
You're going to get a lot of mileage out of this over the course of our watch here. And I like it.
Get some mileage out of this. We have another scheming Roman MILF played by Lucy Lawless.
Another outstanding character.
Oh, an outstanding example of the breed. First prize. I find it very funny that there are so many Australian actors in it. I know it was because it was filmed in the Antipodes in some way.
Yeah, there are a lot of New Zealand actors too.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what the reason for that was. It may have been a co-production between some.
I've just written here Rome and Away.
In the kind of interstitial season that goes after this one, Gods of the Arena, the guy who plays the doctore of the gladiatorial school is Temuera Morrison, who plays Boba Fett, and also Moana's dad, which I fucking love. He's one of my favorite actors. I adore Temuera Morrison. They really got, like, in some roles, not all of them, they got really, really, really perfect casting.
Interesting. Okay.
Lucy Lawless, perfect.
Yeah. I mean, I did start to think about, like, because, you know, he plays that elf, Glaber plays that elf who, like, gets, like, clonked over the head and killed by an orc.
He's the one who says the dwarf breathes so loud we could have shot him in the dark. That one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had not made that fucking connection. I didn't get the elf reference at all.
You're like a kind of 1,000-year-old elf knight. Like, how are you going to get snuck up on by an orc? Like, are you stupid?
You should have heard that fucking orc coming, man.
I feel like you should have done. That's my complaint about that. All the Romans are pure evil and also gay. That's another observation. Then there's one guy who looks like Roman Peter Stringfellow. I've also said, okay, so this is potentially a niche reference even for me and even for the listeners of the show. But Pat, have you ever seen the Baz Luhrmann classic Strictly Ballroom?
No. One of the few Baz Luhrmann movies I haven't seen, actually.
Oh, well, you know, you honestly should correct this, because Strictly Ballroom is one of the best films ever made. And it is about the son of a pair of former ballroom dancing champions, and he's going to be like the next big thing in open amateur Australian ballroom. And he decides that he doesn't want to dance the kind of prescribed steps, and he wants to make up his own work. And he like messes up his chances at a competition by going off piste. He meets this young woman who is from this Australian Spanish family, and she teaches him flamenco, and it's fucking great. It is a fucking great film. And I will sing its praises to the high heavens. The main guy in it is, interestingly, he's not a Paddington, because he changes a bunch, but he's another one of these kind of projecty foil types, because he's a dancer. He's a professional ballet dancer. He cannot act at all, like not even like a tiny, tiny bit, but he is so incredibly beautiful to watch. There is a character in Strictly Ballroom who is called Ken Railings, who is the hot tub king. And he looks exactly like one of the characters in this show. So I have just put Roman Ken Railings, but I'm going to find a picture for you and you're going to see what I mean. One moment.
I love the concept of a hot tub king also, just on general principle.
Well, I think in many ways, I think if you sell hot tubs, I think you are a hot tub king.
Yeah.
I think it's like one of those things. It's like, you know, there's like nothing like in between, like someone who doesn't do porn and a porn star.
Yes.
If you're doing porn, you are a porn star.
Yeah. If you're doing hot tubs, you're a hot tub king. I think it's like
that. If you're doing hot tubs, you're a hot tub king. Yeah. Exactly.
There's a now defunct hot tub store by my house. And this, even though the place is defunct and it's surrounded by fences, its sign, like its little billboard is still up, and it will always say, until the sign goes down, your wife called and said it's okay. And I have always looked at that and I've thought, God, that really sums up something about gender relations in Arizona.
Okay, you know what? I can't find this picture, so you're just gonna have to Google Ken Railings the hot tub king.
Oh, Phoebe, I don't doubt you for a second.
and you will see what I mean. I assume also that you've never seen Home and Away, which is why you looked baffled when I said they should have called it Rome and Away.
No, I just didn't catch that one. I have seen Home and Away.
Okay, yeah. I was happy with that.
Yeah, no, that was a good one. I didn't catch it at the time.
Okay.
That's not on you.
It's on me. I should have said it louder. I should have tapped my mic. We've got a lot of slow motion in this episode. Anything without words was considered for slow motion. We've got blood flying everywhere. We've got some slow motion sex scenes. I've put here, and I should be clear, this is an approving note. No jokes in it at all, with just like a row of exclamation marks. And it just feels really weird now to watch a TV show that doesn't have any fucking jokes in it.
Yeah, because we've all been Joss Whedonized in the last 15 years. This is a pre-Joss Whedon Avengers production.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because like we're now like so like I can't remember the last time I watched a like a drama series that didn't have a bunch of jokes in it. But it's also really hard to find a comedy series that has any jokes in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. So what they should do? It's just a suggestion. It's just a suggestion. You put the jokes back in the comedy shows and take the jokes out of the drama.
Yeah, because it's not like you can't be funny without making jokes, right? Yeah. Like you could, like this show, even in this first episode, which is pretty goddamn bleak, there are still things that are funny.
Yeah.
But they're not funny because the characters are quipping. They're funny because they're funny.
Yeah, which is fine. That doesn't bother me at all. Like, yeah, I just don't want thing. Jokes. In,
yeah, there's in actually a surprising amount of humor in this show as we go on. There are lots of things that are funny and moments that are obviously there because they're funny, but they're not jokes.
No.
And that's not the same thing. I'm really glad you made that distinction.
Yeah, that is a distinction. Like, you're not going to have like someone who's like, wait, did you say... Sarah Spartacus. I'm Spartacus. Oh wait, no, hang on. No, I'm Greg. I don't know why I said
Chris Spartacus. Hemsworth ass joke
I
right
got,
there.
I got confused there. I'm Greg. And then right at the end, just in case you were wondering whether we were gonna have a little scene where he gets assigned his new name. We do have John Hannah saying, "Oh, the way he fights like the Thracian king of old, his name was Spartacus." And like in a way you kind of hope him that he's going to say something else, like his name was something entirely different,
Steve,
and then someone his name was Steve, and then like the other guy's like, are you sure?
See, that would have been place for a joke. If you were going to make a joke, that would have been the one.
Is that what it says? Yeah, so that's the first episode of Spartacus Blood and Sand. I'm excited to rewatch it now, and yeah,
this is going to be really fun. I am a little disappointed that we didn't get to have Milo here to talk about the dildo helmet, because I think he would have had some good stuff to say on that front.
We can come back to it next week.
Let's make a note of that. I want to hear his dildo helmet take. I think we should kick things off next week with the dildo helmet.
Yeah,
this is going to be so much fun. This series
I'll make a note of
there's
that.
A lot to talk about.
There really, really is. So this has been a free episode. Thank you very much for listening. Hey, we have a Patreon. It is $5 a month. For that, you get all of the bonus material, which is every other episode, and also some movies, and also our entire back catalog. So if you want to go back and listen to it when it was a show about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld, there were also movie episodes. There were riffs only episodes. So there's a bunch of stuff up there. And really, it's not very much money. Particularly now, it's like
$5 is a lot less than it used to be.
Really, it's taking you a lot less. It's not buying you as many eggs as it once upon a time used to. But yeah. So other than that, we will thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week. Marla will be back next week. And yeah, just about does it. Bye-bye.
Bye.